Robin Williams' HBO tour was called Weapons of Self-Destruction.
Anthony Men don't need help. They're the patriarch.
But are they fine?
Turning chaos into control. It's all about just having a conversation.
Athletes and old men and young men.
You're listening to Black Sheep Cycling's Mancast.
Welcome to the third episode of The Man Rides. My name is Trav White and I'm here with Nick Howe again. How are you, Nick?
Good, mate. Looking forward to it.
Looking forward to it. Today we're graced by Jason Roberts. He's been a long-time man rider.
And also a celebrity chef. He's travelled all around America.
Australia. He's graced ourselves on television both in America and also in Australia. And currently, I believe you are in Manly in the warfare.
No, he's not.
No, need to update that website, I reckon.
That's Wikipedia. If you go to your search, it's really going to bite you in the balls.
I'm going to leave this podcast too.
If you're reading Wikipedia, bud, my birthday says February 5th too, and it's off by 4 days. So yeah, don't believe everything.
Too, which we know is a lot.
So I'll let you do the intro for yourself. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? Because I've done a bad job.
No, that wasn't too bad. I don't work in Manly anymore, and I've been a supporter of the Man Ride. I wouldn't say I'm a man rider. My girlfriend might get offended. That could cause some problems for me and my family, and my son may have some questions about that too. But I guess my foray into the industry or the hospitality industry as a chef, it's been quite interesting. I want to cook for the entirety of my life since I was four, having grown up in a world of or a family of professionals or cooking professionals with my grandparents. I didn't want to do anything else but cook, so there was a no-brainer for me. It's an interesting industry. Once I'd gotten into it, I didn't realize what I was up for, but when I embraced it, it became my world, and it became my world very quickly, and it is who I am, and I love it. I love it dearly. I love it for what it is. I love it for all its faults. I love it for all the positive things to it as well. I love that we feed people. I love that it brings people together. There are some sides to the hospitality industry that are a little grey, a little dark, and a little frustrating, and a little sad at times too. And I think it comes with wisdom, it comes with age, it comes from having spent a lot of time watching people. Very interesting for that screw industry. I think it set another platform for chefs to think that they had to achieve. I needed to become a celebrity. I needed to find ways to be seen or be heard. I needed to have a social media following. I needed to have a TV show, and if I didn't, I wasn't as good as those guys. The interesting part of that, about that, those who do, and those who can't work on television. So it's been a fine line, you know, because for me to do television and having credibility in the industry, it was tough because it almost came out like I was, I don't know, skiving a little bit. I wasn't putting my time into the industry and to the apprentices, but I saw it at the age of 27, 28, when I took on this position with Channel 9 back in 2000. I saw it as an opportunity to grow more, see more, be seen in front of people and teach my experience and teach my skills. But for those who are watching, they don't see what's going on behind the scenes and the career that I was running, because I was running a two-hatted restaurant in Sydney called Bistro Moncur at the same time as doing this show, and the show was 5 days a week. So I was literally working 7 days a week for 2 solid years. And in those last 2 years of doing the show, I pulled away from the restaurant. So, I mean, I cut my teeth and I certainly did my hours. But the industry itself has been, it's been a little bit crazy because I've watched people come and go. I watch people middle age. You just leave it because it's too hard. It's death by real estate now, certainly in Sydney. The prices of brick and mortar has increased. And when you're someone who's driven by pride and ego, doesn't matter what you put on a plate if customers aren't coming in the door and paying the bills and staff's not being paid. So there's a lot of weight on your shoulder. So it's a fickle industry. It's a troubled industry, but the industry is evolving too. So I guess that's my – sorry, Nick, go ahead, bud.
Sorry, Jason, to me cut you off. But you're obviously an advocate of food and what it can do for your health positively, but you also talk about the dark side of the industry. Cutting straight to the chase, we all know that – it's a troubled and a high-pressure environment for chefs to work in. You've now got the challenges of social media and so on, which have only added to the pressures of a chef. Tell us a little bit about the industry, actually what it's like working in the kitchen. Christ, it's hard enough getting bacon and eggs to the table in my household, you know, trying to get a four-course meal out to multiple guests. So, you know, that's a high-pressure environment to work in. What's that like?
I was doing a little bit of research before I jumped on here too, because I want to have good information, but it's everything that I've read and that I read into about this industry, it's an industry that I've worked in and love. But, you know, it's no secret the restaurant game is a brutal one. With grueling hours, it's, you know, antisocial hours, super fierce competition, the pressure of maintaining a customer service, finding success in a very unique world can be super intense. It's very male-dominated industry, lots of drugs, lots of alcohol abuse, a lot of underlying issues. People don't get a chance to really discover who they are. Let's say 17, 18, you're thrusted from high school into the industry. You have a love and a passion for wanting to cook, but you get straight into the industry. And now unless you have good peers, good mentors, you're going straight into that environment. And it's an environment that's, like I said, drugs, alcohol, there's nothing positive about it. You don't have a chef who's going, hey, mate, go and enjoy your Saturday. Good game. Have a good game of soccer. They're going, I'll see you at work. Thanks. 6:30, 7 o'clock that morning. And I think, I don't know what it was, guys, but I took on a head chef's position when I was 23 and 90% of my staff were older than me. My outlet at the time was actually surfing. So if I could, I'd surf in the day and I'd work at night. But when I became head chef, there was just something instinctively in me that would push for my staff to have an outlet other than their work or a cookbook. I wanted them to go out running. I'd always work out my rosters around their outside opportunities. So I don't think it was, you know, if it was the gym or it was probably just the gym for most of the people I worked with. You know, it wasn't really about cycling or that, but maybe surfing. So I always encourage that. So the thing I'm trying to get to is that as a young apprentice, without someone there to guide you on how to look out for yourself. I mean, I was fortunate. I don't know what was. I sidestepped. I had no relationship with drugs or alcohol. I was just very, very lucky. I worked with a great mentor who taught me about life, love, music. So he went beyond just food and running a restaurant. He taught me about all these outlets. So I was just very lucky. So it was easy for me to mentor younger apprentices, actually even people of my age and older, and encourage them. But over the years, I guess with my career, quote unquote, the celebrity side of it and traveling, whether it be here or the States or anywhere in the world, you sort of, it's a restaurant is out of sight, out of mind, and you're there building your own social content, your own social media, you're creating other opportunities and avenues for yourself. But in the last few years, the loss of great chefs like Darren Simpson or Jeremy Strode has been crushing for the industry, because when you hear of something like that, when you hear of someone like Jeremy Strode, who's held a couple of hats, as had Darren, for a young apprentice who's worked under them, it almost seems like, well, if I can't make it, there's always an option of suicide. I have a good friend of mine in the States, Seamus Mullen, and he, and this would be a hard one for him to talk about because I just saw him a few months back, and he had a young apprentice, actually a father had come to him and said, look, my young son who's interested in the industry, would you look after him? Would you mentor him? And Seamus took him on board. A few months ago, the kid blew his head off. How do you go back? What kid's lost his life? A father's lost a son. A chef has lost an apprentice. Where does it stop? So, it affects everybody. But to think that there wasn't an outlet for it, I get frustrated sometimes because Jeremy Strode, for example, he was an ambassador for Are You Okay? He took his life.
Yeah.
How does that work?
And what is it particularly about the industry? I mean, I think I remember having a conversation last year with you on the Man on Ride about antisocial hours, particularly needing space and time to go and enjoy life after work, which is often late and probably involves drinking drugs. Is it just that or is there more to it than that?
It's what it is. It's there is no support. I think that's what I was trying to get at by talking about mentorship and sidestepping drugs and alcohol, is to have someone on your shoulder saying, stay the fuck away from all those things. When I was an apprentice, my first or second year of my apprentice, the woman that I worked with, Megan Brown, was incredible. I used to come to work tired. I think I was going down to the Bondi Hotel and dancing in front of the mirror or something like that. She called my dad, who I'd met literally a year earlier, and I was sleeping at the back of his television on a little mattress on the floor. So she called him and said, Jason's coming to work, tired. He's rolling the eyes in the back of his head. Can you do something about it? My dad grounded me. I was bloody 18. But I stuck to it. I mean, for a couple of weeks, he wouldn't let me go to the Bondi Hotel. I wasn't drinking or doing anything. But what it was, that was someone saying, Jason, don't fuck up. Here's your chance. I'm going to look out for you. clearly, you know, I was coming to work and I was doing my work, but she was looking out for me. So I've always identified with those people who are reaching out and saying, hey, this is the road you need to be on. And fortunately in my career, there's been many roads, and for some, there's not enough. So I think it's identifying your peers and the people around you. And so it's one thing to ask, are you okay? Sometimes it frustrates me, that saying, because I don't think people really hear what you're saying. It's, can I actually do something for you? And so sometimes it goes beyond, can I do something for you? It's, well, here's a doorway for you. Come with me through it. I can show you. It's actually really cool. So that's what cycling is for me. It's a doorway. It's an opportunity for me to meditate, to think, to exercise. I mean, cycling for me is pure selfishness. I love it. Mm. But if I can't have that, I feel like I'm no good to anyone. So yeah. The industry, bud, it is antisocial, drugs, alcohol, without someone, without any guidance. When you're a young person, you fall into that, you don't know who to turn to when the shit hits the ground. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
I know, I think from what I hear, the word that I had heard when it comes to Jeremy was that, you know, Jeremy had gone on holiday and he was on antidepressants. And I think whilst he was on holiday, he came off his antidepressants. And I believe it was his first day back at work. And without the help of his antidepressants, something clicked. He jumped in front of a train. So it's a tough pill to swallow when you hear a story like that. Because initially I was frustrated. I was thinking to myself, how would you do that to your family, your kids? But sometimes there's an imbalance. It's a chemical imbalance. And it's a tricky one. It's a tricky one. All I can suggest to people is get a bike and ride it. Be happy. Bikes of that, yeah. Energy that comes from riding a bike and being around your mates is amazing. That man ride last year blew my mind. And if anyone else had been there, Nick, you get it. Johnny gets it. All the guys who rode it did it. That was probably one of the hardest rides you'd ever do. It wasn't the fact that it was 1,000 Ks over 5 days. It was the fact that you had a headwind pretty much the whole time. You had rain. The most amazing thing was you had the support of 7, 8 other riders around you who you would talk to. And then the ride become effortless. My journey was about self-awareness. Most incredible thing. I think this is what's really cool, is trying to find, and I think this is why I like doing the long rides, and I attach myself to anything and everything. So I do the Bono de Berry because it raises awareness for dementia and Alzheimer's, and I don't have dementia and Alzheimer's in my family, but I'm making myself more aware of what could potentially happen and where I could help, where I could be helped if it was to happen. I just signed up and offered some recipes for a book that's coming out to help facilitate feeding or getting money to farmers. I'll do whatever I can because I feel like that's my strength. And cycling is just such a great opportunity to do that.
Jace, so you spoke a lot about, like, I guess you spoke a lot about before about mentorship and your journey to where you are today. You definitely seem like a high achiever. So no doubt you put a lot of pressure on yourself to perform. I think probably like to dig a little bit deeper just to find out exactly where it all started and kind of hear a New Zealand twang in your voice. Can you tell us a little bit about like how you got, I'm not trying to keep it within maybe 20 minutes, but how you got to where you are today. And I guess maybe some of the struggles that you had along that journey to where you are today, because no doubt it probably mentally, physically would have been fairly exhausting for you along that journey.
So save the really good bits for the book deal, mate. You don't want to spend those all on this podcast.
Well, let me start with telling you, yes, I am from New Zealand, bro. I come from a very small family, and we are just choice. No, look, 20 minutes, I could probably sum it up. And as far as the juicy bits, there's not really any juicy bits.
It's interesting because there's three key.
No, it's interesting, boys. Do you know why? Because I think the things that I used to think were the juicy bits aren't really juicy at all, because I think we make choices in our life. And the way I look back at my life now, do you know that the song by Johnny Cash, A Boy Named Sue, and about the boy who grew up with the name Sue, and basically he had to grow up being tough because everyone called him Sue. That was his name. His father did it for a reason, because he wanted him to fend for himself. So I grew up, and I have a brother and a sister, and I had a stepfather who was... He was tough on us. He was tough on my mum. And without getting too far into that, I feel like my childhood and my upbringing, I look back at that and I feel I'm quite resilient. My girlfriend hates it, but I'm also very 11th hour. So a lot of the things that could potentially stress someone out, and this is why it works in hospitality, I can make decisions like that because I don't need to set up the premise for something. I don't need to methodically work with something. I don't need to be perfect. I just know that I can work instantly. And I think that's what I love about cycling is because things happen and you have to make changes suddenly. So, but as far as my upbringing, look, I was born in the South Island of New Zealand. At the age of 3 or 4, actually, my parents were very young. My mum was 16. My dad was 17 when they had me, which scares me because my son's is almost to turn 14. And then they'd separated. And at 4, I moved to Queensland where my mum had a partner there. And we grew up on a dairy farm. Actually, it wasn't so bad. We didn't deal with droughts. We dealt with floods. We were dairy farmers. I went to school with 20-odd kids. I had a stepfather who was abusive. He drank alcohol. He was tough on my mom. I had a brother and a stepbrother and stepsister. So I saw the horrible side of alcoholism. I saw lots of fighting. I saw what coke and rum does to people. And then at the age of 13, we had to get out. There were threats. There were threats to my mom from my stepfather. We had welfare services involved. We had to get out of the country. We had to stay in a women's refuge. We got to the airport. This is interesting. I don't know how, but mum basically packed as much as she could. We went to Maribara. We stayed with a friend of hers. We found out that he was on the road. He was threatening to kill us all. He then found out where we were. Then we went into a shelter with the women's refuge. The women's refuge took us from Maribara to Brisbane, which is like a 3-hour drive. We actually had to hide down sort of on the seats or under the seats getting through there because we knew he was on the road, but we didn't know where. We stayed somewhere in Brisbane for a couple of days before we got on a flight to New Zealand. Interesting thing is when we got to the airport to catch that flight, my stepfather had actually arrived at the airport. Then we were circled by the security to get on that flight because we all just panicked. And this was a time when you didn't go out to the airplane through a gate over like a sheltered area. You had to walk out into the tarmac. We honestly thought, my mum squeezed my hand and I was looking at her sideways as a 13, almost 14-year-old boy going, this is it. We thought we were going to get shot. It was horrendous. It really was horrendous. So, I mean, it's probably a pretty full-on story to hear, but like I said, I never look back at my past and think, well, poor me. We grow from these situations. In fact, I've seen my stepfather since and he's mellowed out. And, you know, he was a young guy at the time. You know, sometimes you're not taught how to deal with grief, I guess. And at the time he had to grieve. He didn't realize that when he was drinking how tough he was being on everyone and how abusive he was. So I don't blame him for anything. In fact, I wish him well.
How's that impacted your life though? I mean, obviously being exposed to violence.
Well, Nick, there's a couple of things there, bud. I didn't drink and do drugs. I didn't drink till I was 30. I wanted to stay away from alcohol. I just made it was no good. I'd heard
you reckon that shaped that decision?
Yeah, it did because I became that person that everyone knew that, oh no, Jason doesn't drink. Oh, Jason doesn't do drugs. He's weird. He doesn't do that. But I liked being the odd guy. I liked being the person who was different to everyone. And later in life, that carried me through because I felt like I would never have survived my industry or never gained the accolades if I wasn't straight and narrow. I wouldn't be able to speak from the heart about the things I cared about if I was under the influence of anything. So I honestly don't know what has triggered my career or my understanding of just not to do it. My mum said, don't do it. But I've got plenty of friends whose parents told them not to do it and they were well and truly doing it. Everything just happened later in life for me and because of that as well. I mean, as far as impact, I was scared shitless when I was at that age. I didn't know who my father was till I was 18. So that came a little bit later down the track. And that was actually my end to moving back to Australia, back to Sydney, starting my career. It was fortunate. I have a great relationship with my father now. But as far as...
And how did that come about?
Interesting enough, I think all kids reach a point in their life, and it's a tough one. 16, 17, 18. For me, it was 16, 17. Parents and children, whether it's a smell or it's a hormone, you just hate each other. You can't stop it. It's about leaving the nest. I had to leave the nest. Don't get me wrong. I love my mother. We are best friends. But there was a time I hated being in the same space as her. It was just frustrating. But we were also our living circumstances weren't great. We were living in my auntie's house where I had my cousin, my brother, my sister. There was really wasn't enough room for us all to grow. But I just think it's part of nature that you actually end up not liking each other and then you come back together. I left the country. I didn't just leave home. I left the country. So my mum and I have a great relationship now, as do my brother and sister. So as far as my past and how it has affected me, I think it's made me a stronger, tougher person. When I was going through that time where I couldn't find myself as a kid, I was a late bloomer. I didn't lose my virginity till I was 21. I thought I was gay. I wasn't sure. I mean, I do look very good right now, by the way. Sometimes I could be gay. If you looked at me, I look gay. I go like, shave, yeah, right? I work on it. I shave my legs. I shave my chin. That's why I had to start cycling because I was looking too gay. So I think it was weird because it came with the pressures of the industry as well. I was working 60 and 70 hours a week and it was effortless. I loved it that much. I wasn't meeting girls. So before you've met someone or before you find someone that you're intimate with as far as a relationship, you challenge yourself, you're judged. I felt judged. I was judging myself. So that was a huge one for me because I didn't know what the heck was going on. I wasn't good enough. And sometimes that correlates with the relationship that I didn't have with my own father. He didn't know me. He didn't come to see me because I wasn't good enough. So that's something I probably held under my hat till I actually met him. And then when I met him, I said, so how come you didn't come and see me? He said, well, I didn't want to pay child support. he was brutally honest. Brutally honest. I mean, I didn't
know. Hey, do you reckon like you not having a father and then finding it out, did you go through any sort of, you seem to brush things off quite easily off your shoulders. If we're talking like of a mental thing, when you met your father, how did that affect you? Did you just say, hey, cool, it's dad or was it anger? Or,
do you know what's weird? I tell you what's weird about that, and I'll get into that, but quickly, even to this day, I don't call my father dad and I don't call him by his first name either. I call him father because there's something odd about calling him dad because I never called anyone dad. So it's an odd thing for him. But when he calls me, I call him, hey, father. The funny thing is I have the same relationship with my own son. So my ex-wife and I, we'd separated 12 years ago, 11, 12 years ago. And when I call my son Hunter, I call it boy, he calls me father. It's actually quite funny how that's come about. But interestingly enough, I don't know I really don't know what it is. And this is what's interesting about people in general, everyone is different. I have this ability, and maybe it's something inside me and something that sometimes gets me into trouble, is my ability to just care. So when I met my father, there was some very cognitive in my approach to it. It was like, I wonder how it must feel for him to be meeting his son after 18 years. He must feel like a dick because he didn't pay child support. It must feel odd. I also know that he was 17 when he had me. And then when I met him, I was 18. So it was like me having a one-year-old child. So I sympathized. I totally sympathized with it. So we didn't have the greatest relationship for a long time. But interesting enough, my relationship flourished with him when he told me he had diabetes type 2. And then he started running because he was a drinker. He drank. He was a heavy dude. We were so different. But I think that the thing that we're very similar on is we're quite solo in our approach to life. We could get away with being by ourselves. But he started running, he got rid of the diabetes, like type 2 diabetes, it went away because he was conscious of what he was eating, he was exercising. He'd become like this guru for anyone who had type 2 diabetes. He was sharing his knowledge on it. He was doing all the research and he fixed himself. And I admired that. And it was at a time when I was at Channel 9 and fresh and I was hungry for information and helping people. So we really bonded on that. He ran his knees out basically and then got onto a bike and he loved the bike. He got me onto a bike and we've sort of been great mates since.
Great.
We have a very good bond, but interestingly enough, I think growing up with a single mom or with my stepfather and then the way that relationship had ended with my stepfather, I have a very feminine side too and a very caring and nurturing side. So I think when I was saying about being cognitive and understanding how he must have felt meeting his son after 18 years must have been odd. So I think it's just something I've taken in my stride. I'm aware of a lot of things that's going on. So if you talk about hospitality and suicide that happens within it, and the stress and the anxiety and everything that comes with it. And it's not getting easier. It's actually getting harder because running a restaurant's harder. And chefs at my age, the borderline 43, 44, who have nothing to show for the last 20 years of their career or 25 years of the career, what's next? So it's a very fragile area. So I love all the work on any level that anyone does when it comes to mental awareness. But I think the other thing, that the word that resonates with me a lot on many levels for many different reasons, the word acceptance. We have to accept that we're going to be challenged. We're going to have to accept that there are people who are going to struggle. Acceptance is a big thing. And once you accept it on a personal level and as someone who's an onlooker, just accept that that's just the way life is, that someone has screwed up in their life, someone has struggled. If you can own your mistakes, if you can own that you have issues, then you can move past them. Well, someone once said to me, and I think it's an old adage too, that as a restaurateur, if you owe the bank $500,000, you don't sleep at night. If you owe the bank $500 million, the bank doesn't sleep. So what it is, it's perception. So it's an individual's perception. So as soon as you accept that I can change my perception, you can change a lot of things in your life. Money is not everything. So it's the amount of pressure we put on ourselves. But I think anyone who's listening today, take on board the word acceptance on every level of your life. Just accept that there's nothing in the fridge. You got to go out and get something. Accept that you're not riding as hard today. But you can also take the good with the bad. Because on the other side of it, look what you're actually doing. You're making changes, yes. You're making an effort, and you're tuning in and you're being conscious.
You're aware. Mm. You're aware of it as well.
There's Absolutely. A couple of things I'd like to touch on there, Jace. I mean, there's a few things all kind of wrapped up in one. One is your obvious caring nature. The other one is your father using food and exercise to kind of counter type 2 diabetes. We've talked a lot about the negative side of the industry. I mean, you are a massive advocate for healthy food. Good eating and good food can obviously change a person's mental state as much as anything. Bad food is like alcohol. It can have a real negative effect. I mean, do you think those two things are related in the sense that all of this caring side and your ideals to feed people in a really positive, healthy way are kind of joined forces and brought you to where you are now?
Oh my God, absolutely. You know, and this has been an incredible adventure for me too. My partner, Sammy, he's just finished off a Bachelor of Health Science and now is practicing. And I think the interesting thing about that was when Sammy started her studies at Endeavor College, that the reason for wanting to go there was because there was a lot of stuff out there on social media about people who are curing themselves of brain cancer from eating good foods, which this particular person actually didn't have brain cancer. So there was a lot of false information, like Wikipedia and birth dates. There's a lot of information that's out there on the net that's not proven. It's not science-based. So Sammy wanted to have credibility in the industry. So, and I totally support that and very proud of her. So I think my journey has been almost that's a very similar journey. I mean, I couldn't go back to college and study the way she did. My God, Sammy was just bombarded with exam after paper after exam. And by the way, she did very well. I just couldn't commit that much time or that much energy to going back to studies. But I'm very blessed that she's part of my life and I get to share that journey with her. But that correlation between food and alcohol. And then there was one of these papers that Sammy was working on or something that she was reading out and she'd share some of this information with me was that how alcohol inhibits the bioavailability of nutritional goodness from our food. It is also when someone is on antibiotics, hey, you're not meant to take alcohol or not drink alcohol. Alcohol stops the availability of the goodness from your foods. It stops the pathways for health. So those little nuggets, they start to stick. And then you start to advocate that. And I must admit, I've been that person over the years who finds something, oh, gluten-free. Whoa, that'll help you lose some weight. Or sugar-free or fat-free. You hear these things and then now it's like, well, I'll go ask Sammy about that. I want my information to be real. I don't want to be passing on information because I want to help someone else achieve. I want to help them through with right information. But at the moment, it's a growing process. But I can tell you this, my grandmother said it first, as did everyone else's grandmother, I'm sure. You are what you eat. And it rings true. and you guys will know this, and with cycling alone, if you eat the right foods and you're conscious of your water intake, when you're doing a long ride, the food you eat today is actually for tomorrow. The water you drink for today will help you tomorrow. So I love the science and what the food that you eat, the energy that you intake will help you with the energy going out. And for these long rides and like the man ride, particularly with those days, I knew what I was eating one day was going to help the next. So it's an incredible science. And I love the little tweaks that you can make by reducing things and increasing things and learning about beetroot and how it helps convert oxygen much quicker and all that sort of stuff. And the power of magnesium and then the relief in your muscles and the fact that there's magnesium in the ocean and then jumping in the ocean after a big bike ride is super beneficial. All these things, all these little tweaks are all food, alcohol related. Alcohol's not good. I mean, God, it tastes good though, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's fair to say that what you do put in your mouth can ultimately have effect on your mental state. A good diet makes a hell of a lot of difference. And that's something, particularly talking to a cycling audience, that I think is really interesting. Lots of people out there will feel that they can cycle, but then go off and eat McDonald's.
Yes. Yeah. Nick, I think just quickly too, mate, I feel like I've painted this picture, mate, too, of myself and not having done drugs or alcohol, which is actually not. I mean, I set up until the age of 30, right? Don't get me wrong. And so, there was a period. There actually was.
Success.
So, but listen to this. So, trust me, I've had some tough times in my life as well. But at the age of 30, I got my driver's license. I bought a house. I got married. I had a child. 2 years later, I lost my license. I got divorced. I lost the house. I moved countries. I mean, in the space of 2 years, from having everything to losing everything, it was like the movie Stripes. It was Bill Murray for a day. It's been crazy. So I've had my ups and downs. I lived in the States with the opportunity to be out with mates and have a good time and get on the alcohol. I just physically, to look in a mirror after a week of drinking or being out and not having, I was living the high life. I had great opportunities, heaps of money coming in. And the day that you wake up, you're sober and you look in the mirror like, what the hell happened to my face? My face shows everything. I put weight on straight away. And then there was this particular time, and it was actually after Hurricane Sandy hit, and I was living in New Jersey, and we'd lost power for 2 weeks, and I was eating pizza. I was drinking plenty of beers down under. The premise of where I was living at the time was a wood-fired pizza place, even without power, they could still make pizza. So for 2 weeks, we just got through it. There was no power, no water, and there was a small community of really cool people. We listened to music using batteries, and we ate pizza. And we made the most of a shitty time. I put a lot of weight on. At the time, I'd signed with ABC America for a show called The Tube. We went to Boston to film a piece. I had a social media guy who was working with me. He took a picture. He posted. I said, you didn't just post that picture. I looked at myself, and I looked like Pigsy from Monkey Magic. I remember my face was just huge. And it was literally, for me, I just need to see an image of myself. It's weird. It was basically, I reflected. I could see an image of myself and said, that is it. The next day, alcohol-free, sugar-free, dairy-free, gluten-free. I picked up a personal trainer for 6 months. Just so happens that the personal trainer was the coach of the Polish cycling team way back 20 years ago. And my friend Greg Walczyk, to this day, lives in New Jersey. And we have a great relationship, and it's through cycling and exercising. So I changed all those things, and within a month, I dropped like 15 pounds, equivalent of, say, 7 or 8 kilos, and I found a new me. And I did go gluten-free to the point I was doing everything gluten-free, and I was encouraging it, and I was pushing it. I wrote a cookbook about it, and then, you know, 4 years later, like, yeah, this gluten doesn't really affect me the way I thought it did. I can have a beer. It's all right. So I'm not a celiac. I'm not like 1% of the world who has to really deal with the issues of being a celiac and how gluten could really wreak havoc on your system. But I have, in that 4 years, educated myself on where gluten is and what it does. And all those little things that you thought weren't gluten that actually are gluten, how it's used in a lot of skincare products, how in America, how a lot of wheat is tampered with, how there are products, the anti-caking agents that are super harmful to the body. So once you start digging, as long as you find reliable sources and papers that are written to back up and support what you've read, then I think it's okay to promote that. You have to be careful, but I have to look after number one. And right now, number one's me.
So, Jace, with that, I guess, what are you up to today? Like, obviously, you've moved on from working at Manly, and I'm going to suggest an update on the Wikipedia page. But yeah, what are you doing with yourself? I'm kind of like trolling through your Instagram account with the 52,000 followers and whatnot. So keeping up to date.
I'm working
you have celebrity status.
I tell you, interesting.
Is there a blue tick there?
We are not verified. They could be all from Mexico. We just don't know.
Yeah, you need a blue tick there, mate. We're calling out on that.
Working on that, but I'm verified on Twitter, thank you very much, with 80-something thousand followers. Thank you very much. So I don't know how, at some point, hopefully it just kicks over. But interesting enough, I think with social media, and that becomes a problem in itself, because I think you look at social media, and a lot of people do this, and my fear for the younger people is that they value what people think of them on their social media accounts. Oh, I didn't get many likes on my picture, or someone didn't write something about me. And they need that social engagement. And I fear for it because I see kids every day. I see my own kids getting home from school and going straight to their phone. I'm like, oh my God, what could be so important right now? But then I do the same thing. But it's my work. This is what I get paid for. So for your question, what am I up to right now? I have several companies that I work with. I am part of the Fruitologist family. So I create social content and recipes, and I do cooking classes for those guys. I have a product called Bella Housewares that I represent. I create social content for them. I do live events across New York, Chicago, LA. This is actually where I'm heading off to the States in a couple of days for, is a couple of big events promoting a new product called Chef Built. And then I was going to be doing Chef Cycle in Charlottesville, but now I think I'm going to head to Charlottesville and actually help with some of the recovery and cleanup. I think there's a group of us chefs going to go and do some volunteer work for a bit. And then I'll come back and do Phil's Cookie Fondo on the 27th of October, I believe, in California. So I will get some writing in. So I guess the way my work is now, I still was doing some work at a place here called Huxton's. They had these Italiano nights, so I would go in and cook dinners. I sort of float around. It drives my partner nuts. I seem to keep enough income coming in to, you know, keep food on the table and be happy, you know, and ride my bike. And I think that's what's important. Money doesn't buy happiness, but a bike will.
Yeah, let's talk about the bike for a little bit, actually, because you've mentioned a few times just how you got introduced to it. But there's a couple of really interesting points. One is obviously you rode the Man Ride with us last year. Incredible experience that we all had. And then you just touched briefly on the Chef Cycle. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about Chef Cycle whilst we're talking about it?
Absolutely. Look, I have a tendency to be overachiever. I had the opportunity to meet with Deb and Billy Shaw in DC after a radio interview in DC. And I met with them, and there was something brewing in the back of my mind about riding across America. And I didn't know what for, but I saw an opportunity. Actually, at the time, I was thinking of writing a cookbook called Express, and it was about quick, simple meals. And then I thought, what would be a good way of promoting this? What would be a good PR? And I thought, what if I ride my bike across the country? And in doing so, I could do all the local venues and TV spots. So I would call that Pedal Express. So it was, the book was Express. The idea in a TV platform was Pedal Express. So it was writing to people where they needed to be met, teaching them how to cook. So when I took this to Bill and Debbie Shaw, they said, oh my God, biking is a platform that's on the rise and rise when it comes to charitable events. And incidentally, when I was talking to Deb, we both knew several riders and said, maybe we could transition this to being a ride for No Kid Hungry, which later outturned to be Chef Cycle, which now has close to 300-400 riders. And in this year, we would have risen close to $6 million for kids who don't get breakfast. They say the going statistic at the moment is 1 in 6. A year and a half ago, before we started Chef Cycle, oh my God, this is the fourth year. Before that was 1 in 5 kids. So we actually have made a dent in what's going on. So we've advocated on Capitol Hill. We've helped pass and change some bills when it comes to summer school lunches, because in some environments, some kids just don't get a meal because their parents both working, or one of their parents, or they're in single parent situations. Parents are going, do I pay gas or electricity bills? So there's no food for the table. So these kids need to be fed. And this is where we're trying to make that impact and get food to children. So the Chef Cycle has really grown, but what's cool, and very much like the Man Ride, been about a community. And I think if you're talking about my social media content, I'm consciously trying to build community and build opportunities to work together with people. And social media, as much as I see it as, look, it's a dual-edged sword. You find if you start dealing with social media, you're on it all the time. And in fact, it's very antisocial because it takes you away from your family and your friends because you're not being socially interactive at all. So I need to find times where I actually just switch off from it. But going back to Chef Cycle has been a big part of that too because it's allowed us to engage with corporates, with other chefs. I have cheekily managed to get chefs involved. We have Jeff Bridges, who is the named, and Pink as well, who are the names behind Share Our Strength and Don't Get Hungry. But last year we actually had Pink do the ride. These relationships have been very important to me. And I was very fortunate. Obviously, Black Sheep supported one year with kits for Chef Cycle. So it's these relationships that you build and forge that you hope to maintain and keep. And then, like with any charity, you need to find new ways. It's like any business. You need to find new ways to keep your charity or your event, whatever you're doing, alive. So you have to consciously be thinking. So that's why I guess the social media aspect's important. But with Chef Cycle, for me, it's been an outlet, not unlike the Man Ride, in the sense it's allowed me to build community and talk to my peers, the peers being all hospitality-driven people, and they all suffer. You'd be surprised how many people have got their lives back because of Chef Cycle. And you could almost call it the Chef's Man Ride. They're raising money and awareness for kids who are going hungry, but at the same time, they're getting lives back. There are a number of chefs who've dropped 50, 80, 100 pounds. They found a bike after 25, 30 years. They go, oh my God, I actually love this. And I'm meeting new people. And we don't have to talk about the problems in my kitchen, but I can heal myself at the same time. So I'm blessed. I'm totally blessed with this ride. I should pat myself on the back a little bit more for it, of taking that opportunity to these guys. But some of my best friends who now live in the States, we're all advocates for this ride. It's just awesome. Very fortunate. Very powerful.
So, Jace, I take it you're not going to be a part of the – you're not a part of the Man Ride this year?
Well, I guess, as you put it before, I'm a man rider. I'll always be a man rider.
So, well, I guess the question is, where are you going to be on the 7th of October this year? Because I think we've got the Global Man Ride Day going all around the world. So it doesn't matter where you are.
New York. 7th, I'll be in New York.
Gotcha.
So New York to, I don't know, Washington, round trip. Can't be that.
So New York to Washington is 300 miles one way.
Yeah.
So you're going through Philly. It is a beautiful ride. You're going through New Jersey, you go through Philly, you go through all the Amish country, you go through Baltimore. It is a very, very pretty ride. Getting out through Jersey is horrible. But maybe on that day, maybe I'll go ride up to Bear Mountain and take a picture of myself in a Black Sheep kit and just introduce myself to somebody.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right? You've touched on it a couple of times. You're a provider. Ultimately, you're a provider. You get involved with these causes because you're a caring person.
Yeah.
You love community. And that was very apparent to me last year when we did the Man Ride. I mean, you were a great motivator. You were someone that would always help others out. Talk to me about the whole experience of doing the Man Ride and kind of what that meant to you, given all that you're talking about today.
It was cool for me because initially the Man Ride I knew about because of the year before and the incredible content that you guys put out. And I saw that. And I remember saying to Sammy, we were lying in bed after watching it, and I just said, if I could sum up what would I want my life to look like, it looks like what you guys created as an image. And I just saw this hard work and this guy striving for wanting to share the message and push it out there and help people. But there was something about the sound and how the speed and the rate that piece came out that I just thought was incredible. It was just beautiful. And I said, I want to be that person, if that even translates. To being able to, obviously, to talk to you guys and then be involved in 2018 was just incredible. It was hard to get some training in prior to that, but I remember I'd done the Bondi to Berry, so I'd done 160 Ks one day, and then I thought, well, I'll ride back the next. So we did 300 Ks that weekend, and the following weekend I was in Holyhead. So I got some Ks under my belt, but I felt really good on that ride. I felt good about all the riders that were doing it. But I tell you what, mate, that experience, that I think it was on the first day riding out of Holyhead when we met that woman, Sharon, with a tattoo on her wrist of the jigsaw piece after she'd worked out what we were doing, and she had shared with us that son had gone missing and she felt that it was suicide and jumping off a bridge. Mate, that whole experience from that after that day was goosebumps. It was the most incredible experience with the most incredible people, because we laid ourselves open to finding out more about ourselves and about our own limitations. I mean, there were frustrations on the bike, admittedly, but 200 Ks on a bike with a seat pushed up against your backside and a bit of rubbing, that doesn't leave anyone too happy. But that I just, it will go down in history as, for me, as one of the most monumental, uplifting experiences in my life. It really is. I mean, when I talk about, you know, my career and the things that I've done and the achievement, I've done some great things. I've done some incredible TV shows. I've raised some incredible money. But that bike ride, that was when you're on an aeroplane and someone said, the flight attendant says, you put your mask on first. That bike ride was putting my mask on, because by doing that ride, I have fundamentally been able to help so many more people, because I'm just aware, just socially more conscious of what mental health issues really are.
Well, I think you've definitely, for people listening that haven't done the men ride before, motivating us a little bit. Mm. I guess to throw a little promo plug in there, I guess for those that are listening to the podcast and unable to take part in the 1000 man ride, we are globally doing the man ride day across the world. If you do head to manride.blacksheepcycling.cc, we've got all the details on there and all the cities that we're doing route rides in. You can just go and purchase your free ticket in there. But Jess, thanks so much for catching up with us. It's been pretty interesting learning about what you're up to and
of course,
definitely the whole journey. It's been pretty crazy.
My pleasure, guys. I'm super. Thank you very much for having me. I was just listening to the last podcast that you guys had done, and it was fantastic. I think the more that we share that it's actually socially acceptable that, hey, I have some issues. Sure. I think it's okay to actually talk out about it. Asking, are you okay? It's a start point. But do you know what? Start opening some doors for the people around you. Actually really look at where they're at. Make it a little bit more obvious.
Yeah. The take home for me today is very much you've come through a hell of a lot in your life, and you've got mental resilience to be able to counter those things. But not everyone's in that situation. Not everyone has the mental capacity to deal with those situations. And I think do delve a little bit deeper. Go more than just asking if someone's okay. You know, as you said, open the door for them, offer them a hand, and see if they'll take it.
It might even be just as simple as just asking someone to go out for a ride and have a chat.
Yeah.
I know.
Yep.
The mad mind, we always just go out for a ride if I just need to get it off my head and just into the sky.
Hey, if you're making some bone broth at home, drop a litre off to your neighbour. For no reason, but for every reason.
I can't remember the last time I even made some bone broth at home, but maybe some toast.
Toast. Drop some toast off. Trust me, it'll put a smile on someone. Gluten free, of course. It'll put a smile on someone's face.
Awesome. Well, all thanks right, again, Jace. Mate, pleasure. Thanks heaps for catching up with Nick and myself.
Good luck, mate.
And for anyone who's listening, be sure to hit me up, Chef Jason Roberts, on Instagram. Show some love.
There you go. And I noticed that you've got in Sydney, you've got a night with Chef Jason Roberts kicking about. There's a few in October I saw that you can get around. So there's another little plug that we can get people. How do we find out what these events are?
The cooking?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, okay. So yeah, look, if you just hit me up, follow me. Yeah, you know, just go to my Instagram account, and if you're actually on it, you'll see that I have some classes coming up with foodologists, and we talk about anything from health and nutrition through to just easy, good meals for anyone of any age. Fun times.
Jason Roberts' verified Instagram status coming soon.
Pretty much on Instagram, verify his account.
Oh, God. I love you,
verify ours first, though, please, Black Sheep.
And one thing I will notice, if you are on Zwift too, we've got, I think, well, technically two more rides on Zwift on the 28th of September and the 5th of October at 6 a.m. So if anyone out there, Jason, even if you're on Zwift, you can jump on, head to the Man Ride page.
Just go to Frank's
details.
Studio, mate, where you need to go.
I'll go jump up with Frank's.
Put me on Zwift.
All right, I'll get him. He'll set me up. All right, lads. We'll chat to you soon. Take care, guys. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, guys. Bye. And make sure you leave a review, and we'll chat to you guys next week.
Robin Williams' HBO tour was called Weapons of Self-Destruction.
Men don't need help. They're the patriarch. But are they fine?
Turning chaos into control. It's all about just having conversations.
Athletes and professionals. Old men and young men.
You're listening to Black Sheep Cycling's Mancast.